Over the last two decades, immigration from Eastern Europe has had a transformative impact on Britain. But this has often been discussed, sadly, in xenophobic and racist terms, and Brexit was, of course, the ultimate illustration of this. But a myriad of ties, whether it's personal relationships, workmates, or our art and culture, have formed, binding the people of these islands to those of Eastern Europe like never before. And these are, of course, much stronger than any attempt of Brexit to break them apart. Today we discuss a new and vitally needed book on Eastern Europeans in Britain.
We set up our life here, you know. We've got children here, we've got our houses here, we've got the jobs, we've got the families. We should feel like a part of this community, this country.
When I first moved to UK, I felt like it's a dream come true. It's the country where, you know, there are no differences. People can just get on with each other. There are no questions asked about where you're from, the dialect you're talking with and stuff like that. But now I just have to watch my back.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. Our guest today is Eva Alexandrova, the author of Here to Stay, Eastern Europeans in Britain. The book is part autobiographical, part political, and part polemical. It takes issue with prevalent assumptions in our national political debate and suggests a different way of thinking about our place in this world. We're also joined by Another Europe's Elena Ivanova, beaming in from Scotland. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then. But that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
Hi, Eva. Welcome to the show. And hello, Elena. Welcome back to the show. We're keeping it Bulgarian today. What prompted you to write the book? Was it born of frustration as much as inspiration? It feels like that this might be the case.
I think, yeah, frustration played a very large part of it, as I think is quite clear from the book. But also, to a large extent, kind of through these years of Brexit, pre-Brexit and post-Brexit, I rarely or never really heard anyone that was speaking about immigration and the debate around Brexit for us, for Eastern Europeans. What I was seeing, what I was thinking, experiencing, my feelings, I know many of my friends were experiencing the same, and we didn't see that reflected anywhere. It wasn't reflected in the mainstream media, and it wasn't reflected in the broad left movement, which I was part of. So I thought, and I continued not to see that. So at some point I thought, well, okay, no one's doing this, so maybe I should do it. And that's part of it. And another part was the book was an attempt for me to understand what actually happened during this period and why Eastern Europeans were left under the Brexit bus.
You could really feel the frustration reading it. And I thought, we've said this before on this show, but there's no harm in saying it again. Why not? It really is completely baffling in a way, and a sign of how poorly conceived the whole referendum was in the first place, that without really thinking about it, David Cameron and his government just took that unilateral decision to not give EU nationals a vote in order to try to finish the European question in the Conservative Party, because of course he thought he was going to win. And it kind of speaks to David Cameron or Cameronism, like any political concession, even when it breaches a fundamental principle, like things that are, that any issue that profoundly affects a particular group and their basic rights living in the country, they should have a say over the outcome of that decision. And I think with the history of his administration, there's just a story of a series of opportunistic incremental concessions that he thought would tame the radical right of his party. But of course, as we know, it didn't at all, and in many ways enabled what's happening afterwards.
And Eva, before the referendum, did you feel, I mean, how did you feel about the mobilisation on the left in defence of, you know, migrant voices and migrant rights? Did you feel like we were really quite, I mean, I say we, did you feel like the left in general was slow and maybe, well, just slow to pick up how much of a threat this was?
I think with regards to EU nationals, absolutely. I think before that, before the Brexit debate happened, I actually, the People's Assembly campaign that I was involved with and all other kind of ongoing campaigns at the time, I thought the left really gets migration, that they understand racism and discrimination, and they understand, you know, the impact that policies have on vulnerable groups, particularly migrants. I was genuinely shocked when, you know, we started hearing about Brexit, and yeah, people around me had absolutely no idea about the consequences that this would have.
Elena, let's bring you in, and we'll come back to some of the politics of all this a little bit later, but maybe we could move back into some of the history here, because it's the Bulgarian takeover today, and you're both in a way products of life after communism in Eastern Europe. That's a really prominent theme of the book, Eva, of course, that we'll ask you about in a moment. What was the first time you came to England, actually, Elena? I know from Eva, because it's in the book, but I was just wondering for you.
The first time I came to the UK was actually the first time I had ever been abroad. So I was 14, I had just turned 14, and I had just done my exams that would determine what kind of a high school I would go to. And because I did really well in my exams, my prize from my parents for that was that we would go to Edinburgh to visit a friend of my mother's who lived here at the time. So the first time I went to the UK was actually the first time I had ever been outside of Bulgaria. And yeah, I was 14. It was August, and it was absolutely miserable in Edinburgh. And my kind of lasting memory was that I was constantly wearing every piece of clothing I had brought with me and was freezing throughout this visit.
I also just love the idea that your first view of Britain was Edinburgh.
It's all just castles and rain, yeah. Yeah, I had that classic experience. No, we then went to London for a couple of days, so also saw some sunshine. But yeah, that was the first time I went to the UK. And I have to say that even though the last 10 years of living here have completely obliterated a lot of the kind of optimism and this idealistic picture I had in my mind, but it was back then when I was 14 an absolutely magical place, and I was determined to come back and live here.
And Eva, like, the book is a part autobiographical description of your life too, and your first visit to the UK plays quite a big role for you, because tell us about it. Your dad takes a short-term temporary job in the UK just before communism collapses, right?
Yes. So that was in 1989, just basically before the war came down in November. And my dad's a physics professor, so he went to work in Nottingham University on a research project, ironically started by Margaret Thatcher and her funding for science development. And so we all, so my whole family, my mom, my dad and my brother, we all went to Nottingham to live there for a year. And it was quite, what can I say? I mean, it was, yeah, it was very formative experience for me, because it was also the first time I'd been abroad. It was also the first time I was in the West, and that there was still that division. And actually, retrospectively, the fact that our whole family was allowed to go to the UK was very unusual. Usually they would keep one of the children or one of the parents to make sure that the family comes back and doesn't run away. So the fact they let us all go, according to my parents, was sort of an indication that things were starting to fall apart and the grip was being lost. But then back to Nottingham, I loved it in some ways because it was obviously different. It was really interesting. We had all these expectations about life in the West and, the glitz and the glamour and all the candy in the store. And a lot of it was true. I mean, shops were much fuller than what we were used to. The packaging was much nicer. Television was, much more interesting. There was a lot that was better, but there was also some things that I couldn't really understand. And I write about this in the book. It was the thing that particularly shocked me was the food that we had in the school that we went to, which was a local school in Nottingham. And, we came from Bulgaria. I was being told that we are a poor socialist country and now we are going to the rich Western country. And the food in the canteen was just awful. And it was all the same, every day the same, and nothing in terms of variety or taste. So it was, one of the first kind of realizations that also, these rose-tinted glasses that we all had before we went to the UK, met with a very different reality. And actually, some of the people in the book also talk about this. I think everyone who I interviewed in the book had these really high expectations and different expectations of what life in the UK would be like.
Elena, I've heard you say that as well about the kind of the expectation. I mean, this is not about food, it's about politics. But coming with the expectation that kind of living conditions were a ton better and working conditions would be a ton better and everything would be both freer and kind of more prosperous, and then having that really get destroyed for you. Do you still think, is that a fair analysis?
I think so. And I feel like I've been steeped into this environment where the politics of on the left are supposedly the politics of hope, but also often end up just being a list of grievances, right? So there is still a lot of negativity. And that's definitely kind of impacted on the way I see things. But no, I think it's still a very accurate way to describe this shock that many people coming from Eastern Europe have had in the beginning, just adjusting to life in the UK. Because for so long, maybe I'm just a couple of years younger than Eva and some of the other interviewees in her book. So my memories are more vivid from kind of the early 90s and just after everything supposedly changed. But for so long, the West was supposed to be the opposite of everything that we had or didn't have. So you did expect that once you get there, everything will be better because everything is supposed to be worse where you come from. You have all these like struggles and restrictions that you do. Yeah, you kind of expect that everything would be better, and then you realize actually many things are not, and the contrasts are much starker. And that's still the case. And I think that actually is a process that intensifies in the UK, unfortunately.
I mean, I can't speak to the quality of English school dinners in 2022, but I do think food in general is definitely one of the ways in which our society has completely transformed since the 1960s and 1970s. And in a way, the member entry into the European the European common market, as it was then, was a part of that transformation and change and that interdependence. If you talk to people of that generation, especially who were migrants in the 1960s, I mean, they will tell you the absolute shock of going to the shops when they arrived in Brighton or London and not really being able to buy the fresh fruit and vegetables that they just thought was completely normal in Switzerland or wherever. But also British nationals have exactly the same experience. And of course, this came up in the 76 referendum, because there was always this idea that, yeah, once we join the common market, you'll be able to get camembert in the shops and you'll be able to, our culinary transformation will occur in the UK. And of course, in many respects, that happened. That was true. And of course, migrants brought, you know, and opened restaurants and, you know, it's just one of the features of our cultural lives that has changed, I think, beyond all recognition in a way.
I mean, I think food is usually like one of the default sort of changes that migration brings about, and the immediately positive one. My other realization, my shock, was that, oh my God, they have, you know, like we used to live, most people in Bulgaria live in these blocks of flats. And we sort of always thought that everyone in England or in the West in general would be living in beautiful houses with gardens. And then we arrived in Nottingham and realized that half of the city is, you know, council flats. And that was also another shock for me. Like, oh, but they live in the same houses like we do.
It was, do you remember, like, it, in the kind of midst of the collapse of communism in the Eastern Bloc, there was that kind of joke going around that the problem with Marx was that he was wrong about communism, but he was right about capitalism. Do you feel like your coming to the UK was your first proof of that?
Probably. I mean, I remember that my father's colleague, his sort of counterpart in the University of British Academic, he was a Labour voter. And my parents were shocked. They were like, but how can you support communists? You know how bad the communists are. And he said, well, they're much better than Margaret Thatcher. And my parents were like, but what's the problem with Margaret Thatcher? You know, she's great and she's a woman and there's private property. So it was quite inverse relationship also to politics.
Could I ask you about one of the stories in the book, which is pretty amazing? I mean, it's someone called Camilla that you interviewed. She came to London and you talk about how she was living in a overcrowded flat, cockroach infested. But she has a pretty incredible story thereafter that makes, I mean, it's so incredible that it's almost like a kind of romantic American dream-like story. I've never thought about the British, if there is such a thing as the British dream. But could you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, Camilla is amazing. Yeah, she's a Polish filmmaker and art academic, and she came just when she finished university, when she started university. And she does have this sort of incredible story and incredible energy around her. And she was actually the reason why I started interviewing people, because initially the book was about my own experience and analysis of how migration changed through this decade. But then I spoke to her and I realized this is one of these, yeah, fantastic stories. And I really wanted to have it in the book because I think it encapsulates, actually, because I think Eastern European migration to the UK, to a very large extent, is a success story. You know, people came here to kind of open their eyes and open their perspectives and be part of a much more global environment. And a lot of people, you know, took the opportunities that this presented. I'm also very aware of the successful migrant narrative. And, you know, migration is not a straightforward experience at all. And in individuals' migrants' worth is not whether they have been successful or not, whatever the definition of success is. But it is the case that more often than not, migration is talked about in a negative way. And especially with regards to Eastern Europeans at the time. And that was my attempt with the book, was to not to give an exhaustive, you know, study of what Eastern Europeans, who were the Eastern Europeans that came and what happened with them, but more like to give glimpses of individuals and their stories and what they went through. And it includes the stories of Bulgarians, Alena's one of them, Macedonian, a Polish and a Romanian. And incidentally, also all of us are women. I also didn't start off thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to do like all women book. But somewhere down the line, I thought that's also something that I'd like to, these stories I wanted to tell.
Brexit has happened, and many of the things we warned about are coming true. But no one seems to want to talk about it. Here at Another Europe, we say it's time for meaningful accountability and real scrutiny. And that's where our new project, Brexit Spotlight, comes in. We're breaking the silence and shining a light on the calamities. Find out more at brexitspotlight.org.
So, look, you're obviously on the left, as you mentioned some of your activism at the beginning of this decade earlier around anti-austerity. But you make some pretty apt and stinging criticisms of the British left at times in the book. And you talk about the problems of an internationalism that is only framed and registered around an opposition to British imperialism and its legacy. I thought that was really interesting how you put that together. And could you explain this for us?
When the first sort of signs of Brexit started appearing, I instinctively knew that this would be bad for me, and that this would be bad for people like me. And I tried to explain this to people, and I found they weren't listening. Initially, I thought this was because Eastern European migrants are relatively new to the UK, that, you know, around me, there were no Eastern European migrants in the space when I was there. There were some maybe Greek, Spanish, Italian, but I think I was the only one from Eastern Europe. And I thought, you know, these solidarity bonds weren't developed because we came here quite late. And I still found it a bit strange because obviously most Eastern European migrants are also working class people. And I would have thought that that's where you sort of, the natural ally, the left would see that these are their natural allies, you know, based on this internationalist understanding. But what I found, and Alena was very much part of developing my understanding of this, because I think, because Eastern Europeans came through the enlargement of the EU process, and in this way they couldn't, their arrival and everything that followed from that couldn't be framed in opposition to the British Empire, because the EU doesn't really have a direct relationship to British Empire. And the British left understands empire very well. But it wasn't obvious that they understand in any way what was happening with these arrivals. And I think it's not that there was hostility or anything, but it was just, yeah, they were just being ignored. And I think the reason for this was that, yeah, there was never done, a class analysis was never conducted with regards to Eastern European arrivals. Consequently, no framework in which to understand what was happening was developed. And for the regular activists on the left, they felt a bit lost because they didn't know where to situate what was happening.
To an extent, what we started today's podcast with a little bit around the votes and who got to vote in the referendum and how much that was, that only became an issue really post factum. That only really became a big complaint and a talking point after it was decided and after the referendum had happened and people were saying, oh, wasn't it a shame that all these people didn't get to have a vote? And I think part of the kind of the crux of this issue is that the British left very much responds to the question of migration, yes, on the kind of axis of empire, but also in this quite crude, actually, rationalization of who owes what to whom. So migration is seen as part of almost a transactional process where migration is a response to acts of aggression, or migration is a response to acts of like cultural appropriation or land grabs, empire, and all the rest of it, rather than seeing migration as a fundamental human process, like a fact of life, as you know, boring as that may sound, and therefore needing to have a philosophy around it and a response around it that does not depend on your country of origin having had an impact on another person's country of origin in order for you to like care about what happens to them, or even in order for you to make space for them and make space for their experiences and voices and their political participation. And I think that's another reason why kind of Eastern Europeans, they were kind of ignored.
We're not deserving enough.
Yeah, we've not been sinned against by the British Empire enough.
I think that's really true. And I think there's also a sense that because that kind of communist, any kind of former communist country is somebody else's problem because we never voted for any communists, if you see what I mean. There's this kind of, you know, any migratory patterns that you would observe, that's going to be somebody else's problem, which I think is a really peculiar but quite kind of tangible sense, even on the left and especially on the kind of mainstream.
I absolutely agree with this. And another thing that baffled me sort of in these weird years was that at some point there was a proposal that was circulating around the left that, you see, okay, freedom of movement has ended, so that's done. But what the left should be arguing for is that, you know, we developed the concept of freedom of movement, but it's not applied anymore to Europeans, but it's applied to people and countries whose people have suffered more from empire or from capitalism or from structural adjustment programs. And I found that absolutely bizarre, because you're just replacing different types of people that you feel that you have a responsibility towards without recognizing any of the kind of agency of people and, yeah, the historical sort of realities.
The other factor that makes Central and Eastern Europe always tricky for the British left is that because a number of the governments in Central and Eastern Europe have often aligned with the British centre-right. I mean, you mentioned how your parents liking Margaret Thatcher earlier. I don't know if you both agree or not, but, you know, it's probably reasonable to say that in post-communist Europe, there's a much stronger sense that Thatcher did something good compared to if you went to France, if you went to Spain and you talked to the labour movement there. There's just a very different set of historical trajectories between the two places that frames perceptions of that particular British leader and that particular experience, right? So, you know, there's because of the force of Thatcher's anti-communism, which we would see, I think, obviously, as, you know, having this horrible McCarthyite element. But of course, in different places, when you're living under communist systems that were extremely oppressive, that's not going to be as clear to very large numbers of people. And I think we still live to some degree with that history.
Do you know, though, that the Margaret Thatcher is the favourite politician of the leader of the Bulgarian Socialist Party currently? She often states that.
Really?
Yeah.
That shows you more the state of Bulgaria's Socialist Party than anything.
As a kind of a generalization, I think it's absolutely true. But again, this is something that I think is a missed opportunity on the British left, because of this feeling that both a lot of the respondents in Eva's book recognize, but also we've previously talked about a lot, and it's this disparity between the idealization of the UK or the West and the lived experience of people coming from Eastern Europe. So you have, yes, you have a group of working class people that come here with high expectations, and some of those expectations are not going to be met. And you have the perfect conditions at that point to actually, you know, politically engage people with ideas on the left. And this is something that in a slightly bizarre way, even I've had that influence over my family, for example. It's because I've lived in the UK, and through me, my parents witness some of the excesses of that late stage capitalism. But I think the reality of life post socialism in those countries, but also outside of those countries, for people who have escaped, is an excellent breeding ground for turning people more sympathetic to the left, if only the left would speak to them.
Yeah, I mean, to row back on my slightly essentializing generalization that I made a moment ago, I mean, in the kind of intellectual circles and activist circles that I've encountered in Central and Eastern Europe, I would say that there's actually the presence of a really strong critique of neoliberalism now. But I think that that's a product of, I don't know, some of the transformations of the last 15 years, if you see what I mean. It's just, I think in its origins, they're still coming from quite a different place.
I think our experience with socialism, but also probably more importantly, the transition, is still something that is little understood, widely probably misunderstood, both at home and abroad. And I think that's for different reasons. You know, the way the UK looks at the transition is different from the way we experienced it. And I think, you know, you can have, people have a lot of criticisms about the system that we lived in, and rightly so. And we did have this also, you know, fantastic expectations of what would happen when capitalism comes. And of course, that reality has been very different. And that these transition years were also very difficult. People lost their jobs, they lost, you know, their ability to keep their families fed and warm and safe. And this, I think, shook everyone's sort of view of the world. And I think many people are still, you know, that's not really processed. And our political leaders and organizations back in Eastern Europe, at least I think in Bulgaria, I guess Poland and other countries are a bit of a different context. This hasn't really been discussed. And I agree with Elena that this is a perfect sort of breathing ground for, you know, kind of a progressive offer that can be made both to Eastern Europeans in the UK as well as to Eastern Europeans in Eastern Europe.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. But the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's extra time, we ask whether the game is finally up for Boris Johnson. It's a good chat. If you want to listen to it, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join at anotheryourope.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.